Hey, welcome back to Passive Income Pilots, everyone. Another week here learning about financial and investing education. I'm Tate Duryea here with my buddy Ryan Gibson. What's up, Ryan?
Not much, Tate. Good to see you.
Good to see you.
Congrats on your sister and her wedding.
Thank you. Two kids in one summer, I tell you what.
Yeah, it's been a good wedding season for you, I guess.
It has. It has. It's wedding season for sure, and it was beautiful.
Nice. Well, I'm excited today about the guest because we want to show you a real world example of how you can invest in stuff that we talk about on this show. So for example, we talked, I think in episode number 3 or 4 about opportunity zones, and everybody's probably like, what the heck is that? And we've also talked about self-directed IRA investing. We've also talked about using your life insurance to actually invest, to leverage and invest in real estate.
Episode 70.
Yeah, episode 70. So if you haven't listened to episode 70, maybe you want to rewind and go back to that episode to learn all about how to leverage your life insurance to invest in real estate, get a better multiple, and get a death benefit, which is fun. And then we've been talking a lot about on the show, the short-term rental tax loophole.
Big time.
And then we've also talked about depreciation and cost segregation. Well, guess what? This episode smashes all that stuff together and a really fun story. Yeah.
Yeah. Casey Roloff is an interesting guy. He's built an entire town on the Washington coast called Seabrook, bought the acreage and started from nothing 25 years ago and has turned it into this incredible little community that, Ryan, you have vacationed there. So while this might seem, you know, if you're Atlanta-based or you're on the East Coast, this might seem like a far-flung thing, but great opportunity to look at sort of a turnkey investment product that's sort of like the Sirius episode, is more of a lifestyle play that has a tax component to it. We're certainly not endorsing this investment. We're not trying to, you know, sell Casey's town here, but it's a really interesting, could be solution for those who want to take advantage of that short-term rental loophole and don't necessarily want to get their hands dirty finding that STR and getting a bunch of sweat equity. So Ryan, I know you've stayed in Seabrook. It's cool. It's an amazing little town.
Yeah. I mean, who's run into somebody who's built an entire city, literally? And, you know, that's the interview guest. But, you know, you bring up a really good point, which is you may listen to this episode. You might be thinking, why would I want to invest in Seabrook? We're not endorsing this investment at all, although it's a great place to vacation. I've been there twice. But, you know, whenever I go visit a place, I always think like, who built this place? How did it get founded? How did it get started? How can I invest there? And then you walk into the front office or you look at the real estate listings in a community town and you see $1 million for a house. And you might be thinking like, how could I ever pay $1 million for a house in a resort town? And you might be thinking like, the only way I can do that is to save up, you know, for a $300,000 or $400,000 down payment, put that money down, and then rent it out as a rental strategy. And what the point of this episode is to show you that you might have considerable tax savings because of where this community is located inside this opportunity zone. You might be able to use the short-term rental loophole in addition to that to shield some of your taxable income from Delta or from United or from Hawaiian or wherever you're working. And then also, it's going to give you the option potentially as well to maybe use your self-directed IRA or your 401k, whatever it might be, to self-direct into to buy this or leverage your life insurance strategy. All these things kind of converge on something like this. And at the end of the day, you end up with a really cool rental property that you might actually want to personally use. Now, again, this might exist on the East Coast. They might have this down in Florida. They might have this down in the southwestern portion of the United States. But here's a real look at an opportunity zone investment that happens to be the only seaside community in Washington. And you can take advantage of all these tax strategies and investing strategies that we've talked about on the show. So that's why when I bumped into Casey, when I was touring Seabrook or walking around with my family, I was like, I got to get this guy on and just talk about how you can take all these strategies that we're talking about on the show and combine them all into one. And then all of a sudden that $1 million house maybe becomes like $500,000 or $600,000 when you add up all the tax benefits and you add up all the income you can earn from that. And you go, oh, that's actually a lot more achievable potentially when I look and use all the tools in my toolbox that we learn on Passive Income Pilots.
Definitely. And it's also an asset that you can enjoy as something that your family enjoys. you know, it's very much like our episode about the airplanes. It could be a lifestyle asset. You know, investing doesn't always have to be, how do I get the highest IRR? It can also be about, hey, how can I make a strategic investment that over the long term will appreciate and I get to enjoy along the way? So just something to think about when you're thinking about, you know, a long-term legacy asset where the mortgage is going to melt away for the next 30 years, and then you own that asset outright. Something that could work for your strategy, just to get the ideas rolling and the creative juices flowing. So in any case, it's a super interesting story. Let's get to the show.
Welcome to Passive Income Pilots, where pilots upgrade their money. This is the definitive source for personal finance and investment tactics for aviators. We interview world-renowned experts and share these lessons with the flying community. So if you're ready for practical knowledge and insights, let's roll.
Casey, so nice to have you on the show. I had the opportunity to go vacation in a community that you built in Seabrook, Washington. So thanks for coming on.
Yeah, appreciate being here. I'm excited to talk about our story.
Yeah, so why don't we go ahead and kick that off? I mean, how did you go about building a seaside town in Washington? What, one of the only seaside towns in Washington?
Well, it was kind of an unlikely journey. I was a real flaky kid in high school and met my Mrs. Wright and decided to get my act together, went off to community college, wanted to get my four-year degree at UPS in Tacoma, but tuition was too expensive. So I started a house painting business, but I didn't have any money. So I got $1,000 Home Depot credit card and I bought some ladders and, you know, rollers and brushes and all that stuff and rented a spray machine and painted my way through college, got a business degree. I got married about that time and then moved down to the Oregon coast. But the best thing was we had no development background or construction background. And so it actually allowed us to look at development in a new lens. And I grew up on a cul-de-sac, and anything I wanted to do, I would have to ask my mom or dad, like, hey, can you drive me here? Can you take me over to my friend's house? It was all drive to. And my wife, Laura, grew up in a neighborhood in Portland where she could walk and bike everywhere. And she had like full independence. She didn't need her parents really to go places. And so I was kind of blown away by that and thought, like, when we raise our family, I want them to live in a place like this. That all started to kind of percolate. And we got into house design. We designed our first house, you know, no formal background, but we're kind of wannabe architects. So we sketched our first house after looking a lot of houses that we loved in old neighborhoods and things like that, and designed a house. But we needed $150,000 to build it, which we didn't have. And so we went out looking for a loan. The banks laughed at us because we had no experience. We were fresh out of college. And then I went to one of the doctors that I had painted his house and his office building. I said, hey, do you know how I could borrow $150,000? He says, absolutely. We have this, you know, high risk real estate fund out of our pension, and we'll loan it to you for 14% interest. And anyway, it was all we could find. And we were able to build the house. It was spec, so we didn't have a buyer for it, which is even, you know, adds even more risk. But thankfully, it sold very quickly. And then we had people just approaching us saying, hey, we've got this lot over here. Will you design and build us a house here? And we're like, oh, sure, you know. And so we basically created a custom home building business and for the next 5 years. And then in 1999, we thought, well, what if we could design our own neighborhood and how would we go about doing that? And all we could think about were the, you know, again, the old neighborhoods that we loved, you know, super walkable, had alleys and narrow streets and you know, shops and restaurants within close proximity. And we learned about this place called Seaside, Florida. And most people, especially from the West Coast, have no idea what it is. But if you saw the Truman Show, it was actually filmed in Seaside, Florida.
No way.
And which was, you know, bittersweet, right? It gave it a lot of exposure, but it also made people think, oh, it's this fake Hollywood set, but it's actually a real place. And if you were to go there today, it feels nothing like what it, you know, looked like on the Truman Show. In fact, a lot of the buildings were fake in the movie, that they were props, but because it was so early on. But anyway, the town ended up being the design of the decade in Time magazine. people travel from all over the world to see and learn about Seaside. And the story of Seaside is really just that they brought back the art of town building. Up until 1920s, when the car was introduced, all we did was build walkable, compact, mixed-use towns and villages. So the most beautiful places in the world, the most desirable places in the world, were all built before the automobile. They weren't built after the automobile. And so they're just like, why did we stop doing this? These places just become more and more valuable, places like Nantucket and Santa Barbara and Carmel and Bozeman, Montana. Like, these are the cool places that everybody wants to be, but we stopped building them, essentially. So we learned about the art of town building, and they basically took us under their wing and gave us the playbook on how to build our own town. So we raced back to the Oregon coast. We were like 27, 28 years old at the time. We found this piece of property. It was 10 acres, and it had been for sale for like 10 years. Nobody wanted it. It was next to an RV park and a mobile home park. And we thought, well, this is it, that we could do a little, you know, kind of test it, see if this will work here. And the doctors ended up putting equity into my real estate deals. And so they put in about $350,000. We scraped up about $75,000, but we still needed a $1.4 million loan. And so once again, reached out to all the banks, said, hey, would you guys want to do this neighborhood? We only need $1.4 million. And they said, oh, Casey, you know, we're doing you a favor. You do not want a development loan. The average days on the market at that time in that community was 270 days on the market. And you can imagine that, you know, anything about Seattle is what, 20 days or something like that. But yeah, 270 days on the market. And there was a glut of inventory, a lot of failed developers. And so they really did think they were helping me by not, you know, approving the loan. And I said, well, the reason nothing is selling is because nobody's designing anything well enough. And people are thirsty for this walkable, mixed use, you know, more community minded design. And they're like, yeah, get out of here. And so I ended up finding a broker who linked us up with a bank in Southern Oregon, you know, probably 5 or 6 hours away from where we were, you know, developing. And they looked at the doctor's financial statements and they're like, oh, we'll do this loan. Because we'll go after the doctors if we don't get our money back. So we launched the project, and I parked a travel trailer, an 18-foot travel trailer at the entrance. And in the first 90 days, we sold out half the community, and we paid off our bank loan in 4 months. So that's when we knew we were onto something really big. If we could sell in this slow of a market, that people were really thirsty for community, they were thirsty for walkability, sold out within the next year, and then we added more and so forth. So we decided we would go find a place to build a town. I leaned over and my wife said, Laura, we've got to build our own town. Like, this is, if we can do this in this market, it just proves the case that this isn't just a Florida thing. This is actually an everywhere thing. So that's what led to the idea of Seabrook. And we were, again, we had just like turned 29, 30 years old or something like that at the time. And we initially looked on the Oregon coast, and we realized that market was saturated, which is, again, kind of what the banks were trying to tell us. So we thought, where would there be a better place to build this? And we thought back to our, you know, camping trips and hiking trips to Olympic National Park along the ocean. And we were just blown away by how spectacular the Washington coast was, basically from the central Washington coast up. And we thought, why isn't there a great beach town closer to Seattle, closer to Bellevue? It just didn't exist. And there's a lot of reasons for that. But we found this amazing site that has that ruggedness that you would find on the Oregon coast or the Northern California coast. But we're 2.5 hours from Seattle, you know, 2.5 hours from Bellevue, 2 to 3 hours. We bought the land. We paid $2.5 million for 250 acres of oceanfront land. That was in 2002. Now, if that would have been on the Oregon coast, it would have probably been like $75 million. The Oregon coast was just more popular, more desirable, people thought. But we saw, I wouldn't trade this for anything on the Oregon coast, by the way, because when we looked at the demographics, we had double the population and 5 times the household wealth within a 3-hour drive based on U.S. Census data. And so, you know, we purchased the first 250 acres. We made about $2.5 million was from that first neighborhood we had made, you know, put in our pocket. And we were young enough and naive enough and crazy enough to just roll the dice, you know, on the Washington coast. And so we bought the land outright. Yeah, I mean, I can go into the financing of it all, but we've done this thing on a shoestring budget the last 20 years. But we've now sold over, I don't know, $600 or $700 million of real estate. And the town has become a real popular destination. But now it's really evolving into a place that more people are going to want to live full time.
There's a lot there that you said that I just want to like unpack. So,
sure.
Number one, I love that you had an idea and you didn't let it go. And you actually found somebody who had done it. And I think a big important lesson is there's always somebody that will help you who's done it. And it's amazing how willing and open people are to share. So if you have an idea and I think you really want to pursue something, there's somebody out there that knows what you want to get done. I think that's the first takeaway that I had. The second takeaway is there's always an investor out there who will give you the equity. There is always an investor out there that will help you put together the financial resources that you don't have. So, you know, this podcast, we talk a lot about like getting the financial resources together, but you did something, you really put yourself out there. You were painting houses, you were doing the gritty thing, and you know, you don't really get anything in life without getting yourself out into the world. And I think you did that. And then that's kind of what connected you to some doctors who had the money. And then, you know, just be ready for the banks to say no. I mean, they always say no. I mean, we built a big community out in Sequim, Washington, and every lender turned us away. We financed that thing like 3 times, and we kind of know what we're doing, right? So I'm sure you run into issues with lenders even today, because even with all the experience, you know, hundreds of acres and building a city, literally, you probably still run into that. So be ready for the challenges. I think that's super important. And then just the last thing, just the vision of, you know, setting out to do it and doing it kind of bootstrapped. I mean, with just buying the land cash and, you know, making sure that you were well protected and kind of rolling your earnings forward. I always say like, you're always inches from gold. You may have worked hard at something for a while and you just give up. And if you would have just swung the axe a couple more times, you would have struck gold. And so just not stopping and, you know, getting this done is just such a fascinating story. But let's dive into the numbers, because I know a lot of people are tuning into this thinking, okay, you know, I personally have visited Seabrook multiple times. I go back there every year with my family. It's an amazing place to go. If you do go, make sure you take a tour with Casey. He gives town hall tours. I think every day at like 11 or something like that. That's how we met. So, and go see how they laid out the city and all the thought that they put into it. It's really fascinating. But we should probably kind of lean into maybe just the opportunity people have to own a seaside house as a second rental property and also rent it out and make income that way. I mean, can you kind of talk into those specifics?
Well, yeah, I mean, just at a high level, I mean, and kind of putting it in perspective. So now Seabrook is 700 acres. So we're building this oceanfront town on the 700 acre piece of land. To compare that, Carmel, California is a 700 acre oceanfront beach town. Carmel is 119 miles from downtown San Francisco and the number one median income in the U.S. Seabrook is, while in the making, is 130 miles from downtown Seattle and downtown Bellevue and the number three median income in the U.S. So this is the closest thing to a Carmel moment our state's ever going to have. There won't be another oceanfront town being built within 2.5 to 3 hours from downtown Seattle. Just the property doesn't exist, the infrastructure doesn't exist, and then most of our coastline's either developed or it's national park. So that's just big picture. You know, if we could have all gone back 50 years ago and bought in Carmel, we would have all scraped up whatever we could because it's become, you know, such a valuable, enduring place. And we think we're just at the early stages of that here on the Washington coast. Anybody that comes in here that's serious or, you know, kind of falls in love with Seabrook, we tell them that it only makes sense if this is a place that you really want to build traditions with your family, your friends, the place you want to hang out. And it's kind of the easy place to get away, meaning you don't need a bunch of gear. You don't need a boat. You can just throw your duffel bag in a car and you can be at the beach and you don't have to think a lot about or prepare a lot to have time out here. But if this is a place that, again, your family falls in love with, and it's a place you can imagine yourself coming, you know, two or three times a year, I would say minimum, then it's like, wow, this could be a good opportunity to own something here and, you know, build wealth through just the town's growth and evolution. We've had higher than normal appreciation rates. Basically, what's one of the things that makes Seabrook really unique is that we saw the vacation rental industry come into the picture in 1997, which is when Vrbo came into the picture, right? Before that, I mean, you had to kind of know someone that had a cabin, or, you know, you see something in the classifieds. It was a very incredibly unsophisticated business. And then Vrbo came into the picture where anybody with a cabin anywhere could post it, you know, on this website. Well, so when we built our first neighborhood, that was all kind of coming at us. I was like, it actually scared me. I was like, well, I want to build this community where people know their neighbors and, again, have a strong community. And I was worried that the problems associated with vacation rentals could erode that. And so the only thing that we could do to really protect ourselves was get into the business and make sure that we had on-site property management and could make sure our guests have a great experience. But also, if the owners that are living there, whether it be part-time or full-time, they knew that the buck stopped with us and that we were there to make sure that we had harmony in the community. 99% of vacation rental companies, they could care less about the neighbor. They only care about the owner of the house that they manage, and then they care about the guest, but they're not really as invested in the community. So we looked at it as a way to really, again, kind of put this little umbrella over our community and protect it so that we didn't have, again, parking issues and parties and, you know, those kinds of things happening. And anything they see, we want them to report that to us. And then we have, of course, 24-hour security and things like that. So, and it's worked. I mean, we're, you know, 25 years in from when we started that first neighborhood. And we've been able to preserve that harmony and that strong community that we envisioned.
So if I'm a pilot, I can buy a house in Seabrook. How much am I looking at typically to buy a house, and what am I getting? What's the typical house look like?
You know, our least expensive kind of, you know, cabin is about 400 to 500 square feet, about $500,000. But that gets your foot in the door. Yeah, it basically opens up all the amenities from our swimming pools, pickleball courts. And then again, everything's within walking distance and biking distance of our town center. So shops, restaurants. I mean, the idea is when you get here, you don't have to get back in your car. And for pilots, we're actually planning a new lounge at the Coquim Airport, which is, what do they call it? Bowerman Airport, and which is an instrument rated airstrip. You can actually land a 747 on that landing strip.
Yeah, I landed there, and I actually got, I rented a Turo car and then drove up to Seabrook for the weekend and then flew home. So it's a great airfield.
Yeah, so we want to have basically some rental cars there, and then also just a shuttle. Because again, you don't really need a car, you just need to get here. Most people don't want to really leave necessarily, unless they're doing a national park, you know, day excursion, which we have shuttles that will take you up there as well. Back to what, you know, you asked. So that's kind of starting $500,000. And then we have houses that are on the full other extreme, the most luxurious, beautifully designed houses in Lux magazine that are going for $5 to $6 million. I mean, they're not even for sale. These are custom, you know, custom homes, custom designed, and they're just purely vacation homes or full-time residences. You don't normally see those get rented out, but there are some couple of really extraordinary houses that are in the rental program. So yeah, that's kind of like, that's the full gambit. But I would say our bread and butter house is about a 3 or 4 bedroom house in the 800 to a million range. They're not cookie cutter houses. These are built, you know, with a really high quality. They're of course designed for the elements here. So they're very resilient.
What kind of revenue would somebody expect to generate on, say, an $800,000 rental in your community per year?
I'm not good with that specific question, but I can tell you that the average home here in 2018 brought in about $40,000 in top line revenue. So now you have to keep in mind, we don't control how much the owner uses the house or how much they want to rent the house or how many restrictions they put on the house. So that's just an average across the board, about $40,000. Today or this year, our average house will average about $60,000 to $62,000 in revenue. So we've had almost a 10% per year increase. And that's just drawing a straight line from 2018 to 2024. And that cuts through the COVID years, which nobody could leave the state. And of course, our numbers were off the charts, right? But if you take that out, just a steady growth, we've had about 10% per year growth. So an average house is that kind of 3 to 4 bedroom house. But then the other variables are, you know, how do you furnish it? How well do you maintain it? Like, we encourage our homeowners to come out at least once a quarter and just walk the house, make sure, you know, everything's in good order. You know, it's a partnership. We're the on-site property management company, but we're not going to look at the house like an owner would. So that's why having a good, an owner that's engaged with the property really helps us do a better job for our homeowners. So that's kind of just high level. If you're, you know, dreaming about owning a house here, if you could just look at it as you're going to cover half of your expenses in the first year. Now, that's not taking advantage of the tax stuff that you and I have talked about. You know, if you were to put 20% down after you pay, you know, your property taxes and your insurance and, you know, your monthly dues, things like that, if you can cover half of your expenses and you can stomach that, well, then it's kind of a no-brainer, because now you've got this place you can go and use a couple hundred nights a year if you want to. But more importantly, that annual revenue is just going to keep ticking up. And of course, today's interest rates, the numbers don't look as good. But if rates are going to go down and income is going to go up, you can just imagine in, you know, 3 or 4 years, I mean, you could be in the black and have this property that's also appreciating. So, I mean, we think that the upside's pretty good.
I'm sure all the listeners are familiar with my Reno Airbnb, and that's exactly what we went into it thinking, is, you know, hey, you know, we'll probably break even or a little bit less for the first few years, but we can refinance it later. Annual income continues to tick up, and opportunity in this case to own seaside property in Washington. Again, if you haven't done it yet, check it out on Google Maps. It's pretty cool. It's directly west of Seattle. Just a legacy asset. I want to get into the tax realm here. This is always the fun stuff, is like, you know, how do we lower our tax bills with investments that we make? What is an opportunity zone, and why would this be declared an opportunity zone? Was it an OZ when you purchased it? How many acres do you currently own, and what are the implications for investors when they bring money into an OZ?
Well, so the OZ, I think, was approved like in 2018, Ryan, you might know it, like maybe 2017, 2018. And it was designed for either new construction after January 1 of 2018, or like major renovations. An opportunity zone, if you bought a building in the International District in Seattle, for example, which is an opportunity zone, and you bought it for $1 million, the way I understand the qualified opportunity zone working is you'd have to put at least $1,001,000 into the building to qualify. Because the idea of the opportunity zone is to create investment, sale of goods, create new jobs in markets that need that. So we're in a county, very rural county, that, you know, used to be a timber, you know, huge timber industry that really dried up. And so this was a natural for the qualified opportunity zone. So when we bought the land, we were, you know, 2002. And so, yeah, it was not an opportunity zone. We didn't know anything about it until 2018. And then when we heard about it, we were like, wow, this is pretty incredible. And I think the Wall Street Journal had an article that described the opportunity zone as a 1031 exchange on steroids, because it has some similarities, but it also has some major differences. The major differences are, if you follow the guidelines for 10 years, all your gains are 100% tax-free, unlike a 1031 exchange where if you own a property for 10 years, you're forced to buy another piece of property to defer the tax. So people that do 1031 exchanges, which is a great way to build wealth, I'm sure a lot of listeners do 1031 exchanges, but you're just kicking the can down the road. Eventually, you know, the tax man has to get paid. And the opportunity zone is a real gift in the IRS code where after that 10-year period, you could take your money and run. You don't have to go and buy anything else. You can just stash it. And that's why we actually have owners here that bought just because they fell in love with Seabrook, but now they've bought additional property, you know, an additional property just for estate planning purposes, because they can hold on to it for 10 to 20 years, take that gain whenever they want in that period of time, and, you know, again, add value to their estate and, you know, pass it down to their family.
If you're not following along with the so what here, here's the so what. So you're a pilot, you just sell a bunch of real estate, you have a massive gain, right? Or you sell a bunch of stocks for a massive gain, you sold all your NVIDIA at the right time or whatever, and you've got stock gain or real estate gain or any gain in your investment.
Sale of a business. I think it's those three. Yeah.
So like, let's say you're sitting here in 2024 and you're saying, oh my gosh, I just made a bunch of money and I'm going to have to pay a lot of taxes. You could buy a house in Seabrook. And as long as you follow the 10-year hold and all the provisions, right, you just buy a house in Seabrook, you enter it into service, and they build it, you know, they're going to have a newly constructed house for you. So you're doubling your amount that you put into the land cost, which they help you do. It's turnkey. You wipe out that gain.
You're able to defer that gain by putting into an OZ, and any gain from within the OZ is tax-free, is how I understand it, right? Correct me if I'm wrong, but let's say you bought NVIDIA stock for $100,000, it went up to $1,000,000, you've got a $900,000 gain. Instead of paying, and you wanted to sell it, you're like, hey, I think it's going to crash for some reason, right? And you want out. If you liquidate that, you have a $900,000 gain, and you'd be able to take that whole $1,000,000 and go invest it somewhere else, and you defer the gain. So the IRS says, okay, you put this into an OZ, no problem. We'll let you coast on paying the tax on it for now. And then when you eventually sell that asset inside of the OZ, 10 years later, you wouldn't have to pay any capital gains tax on the appreciation of the asset within the OZ, that house in Seabrook, right?
Yeah, that's the way we understand it. And of course, we're always never giving tax legal or investment advice. So do your own due diligence and check with your attorneys and your CPAs. But that's generally how OZs work. And now you get this rental property that you can use for personal use. You can rent it out, you can make income on it. It's in a highly desirable, very well-built community that people flock to. And by the way, it's the only seaside community like this in the state of Washington. I mean, if, I don't know if anybody has ever driven the coast from the Pacific Northwest all the way up to the very northwest corner of Washington down the coast. It's a very, very beautiful place. And you know, Casey, I know that you brought this up, but you really don't need a car there. You know, I was actually kind of disappointed. I rented that Toro just to get me up from the airport, and it just sat there in the backyard the whole time. And, you know, I was surprised on how much walkability there was, and the ocean is right there, and top-notch dining and grocery store. Everything is right there. And it does, really become an awesome place to take your family. And you know, and then, you know, I understand people are starting to live there long-term as well. And that percentage is growing.
Real quick, the opportunity zone sunsets December 31st, 2026. So, and all indications are they're going to extend it. And that will, there's more value in the deferment earlier on in the opportunity zone. So like, you don't get as much benefit now because it's ending soon. But when it was 2018, actually you got a longer deferment of paying that initial tax bill. Now that's on the gains that you made before you went into the opportunity zone, because again, the opportunity zone investment, there are no taxes due if you follow the guidelines for that 10-year period. People can look that up obviously themselves and read about that. But the other part of Seabrook that most people don't really know is that it's taken us 20 years to get half of our town center built. That's about 25 shops and restaurants, but we're doubling that over the next 4 years. So there's going to be, with our town center, a new school that's already, the funding's already approved, a new community center, and a new medical center. Over $120 million is going to be invested in our town and our surrounding community over the next 4 years. Now, that doesn't, that, no, you know, homeowners don't pay for that. That's all coming from, of course, our development and, you know, new sales, of course. But so you could buy a $1 million house today, furnish it, and you're done. But meanwhile, we're doubling the size of the town center, adding new amenities, adding a medical center, a new school. I mean, if people think prices are high today, come back in 5 years, because when the town is completely buttoned up and all the construction's out of the town center, it's going to just be more appealing.
That's awesome. Okay, so I have two questions for you. First is seasonality. What does the seasonality look like here? Because I lived in San Diego for a while. It's the ocean's cold there. I can't imagine what it's like in the winter.
Yeah, my daughter's in San Diego, so I know it well. And she's always like, Dad, it's a lot colder than you think down here. You know, it's the Northwest. I mean, people are still flocking to our state and our city because we have something works up here, and it's because we have an incredible natural environment, and we have a very temperate climate. So, you know, with all the smoke and the fires in the summertime, a lot of people are second guessing, you know, kind of the east side of the mountains, east side of the Cascades. But the ocean is always going to be the number one destination for, I don't care where you are, the ocean is always going to be a draw. You know, the mountains are a close second.
Of course. So the follow-up question to this is, when you look at the potential of buying a property down here and short-term renting it, what's the average length of stay? What I'm getting at here is, we've talked a lot about the short-term rental loophole on this show. And, you know, the fact that you can buy an STR, rent it out during the current calendar year, and use bonus depreciation. And that counts as an active offset to W-2 income, which is incredible. You don't have to go about getting real estate professional status. You can just buy a short-term rental. And as long as the average length of stay is 7 days or less within the current calendar year, you can take the depreciation write-offs from that asset in the current year and write it off against your W-2. So I have a lot of conversations with investors. They're saying, you know, oh man, I'd really love to go buy an STR this year, but it sounds like a lot of work and I don't know where to go, blah, blah, blah. So let's explore this option within the context of Seabrook. If somebody comes down to that community and they decide to buy anything from a cabin up to a $2 million house, what does that look like? What is the average length of stay like? Can you make it less than 7 days on average until the following year? What does the property management look like in terms of, you know, can somebody manage it themselves to qualify as for active write-offs? I know that I'm throwing a lot at you, but let's kind of sort of unpack that and explore it.
I didn't answer your first question, is how seasonal is it?
Yeah.
It's a lot busier than you would think. So our average house rents about 175 nights a year. I would think that would be above average across the country. I would think San Diego, I mean, if you've got the right property at the right price, you're probably doing, you know, 250 nights of the year or something like that. But
yeah,
most people are pretty impressed with the occupancy that we get. So it's, of course, summertime, spring break, all the holidays. But I mean, short-term rentals are pretty much limited by school calendars, right? For most people.
Right.
And that's kind of Seabrook. But every weekend, this place fills up. So there's always something going on the weekends. All of our shops and restaurants are open 7 days a week. They wouldn't be open up 7 days a week if there weren't people around here on a year-round basis. And our shops and restaurants are thriving in this market. So, you know, they're doing sales on a per square foot basis of what you'd find in Seattle. It's not a place that goes to sleep. Like, I'll use Chelan, for example, Lake Chelan, which is a popular, I would say it's the number one most popular summer destination, but that place just closes down. I mean, once school hits, it's closed down for the most part, you know, 6-8 months. And then, you know, then it starts to come back. The coast is a real year-round destination. You don't need chains. You're not going over mountain passes. It's just really easy to get to.
Got it. So what does the property management look like if somebody was going to say, you know, I had a really big year in the airline, I want to buy an STR, because I want to be able to write off, let's say, $200,000 against my active income, and I need to buy it somewhere. And I go, you know, taking a look at Seabrook. The requirements are that I self-manage for at least 100 hours in the current calendar year, and that the average length of stay is 7 days, right? Is that something that can be accomplished?
Just real quick, I just want to make sure that if you're listening to this and your mind's blowing on, like, we talked about OZ, right? And we talked about tax deferral for that, right? That defers you selling an investment. So if you have an investment gain, you know, you sell stock, bond, right, business, real estate, and you have a gain from investment activity, this place is special because it's actually deemed an opportunity zone and you could defer those taxes forever, potentially, right? Tate is now clarifying something different in addition to that, right? So that's in addition to your tax deferral from your investment activity. You could also offset your active income from the airlines, right? Your W-2 income, your hard-earned income, by potentially allowing Casey, you know, kind of working with Casey's team on self-managing the property or doing something for a limited period of time. Because remember, guys, you could buy this property on December 15th, actively manage it for 15 days, and then decide that, you know, I think Casey's team would probably do a better job, and then flip it back to them and you get the depreciation. So breaking that down, if it's a $1 million house, you might depreciate $200,000 against your earned income in addition to any OZ investment activity. So I just wanted to make sure we're talking about two very different things that can both add up to hundreds of thousands of dollars in a write-off. I didn't mean to jump in. I just wanted to make sure that we were dissecting the two apart. So what would you say to a guy that says, hey, you know, I want to actively manage this for a limited time. Would you potentially be okay with that?
I think that there's a way for us to do that where an owner can self-manage, and some owners do self-manage, but very few people. It's a lot of work. We make it really easy for people. That's the whole idea, is it's kind of a turnkey operation. And you know, I know people that manage their own short-term rentals, and I know it's a major headache, all the late night calls. And
so the foot stomp for the test here, we're stomping our foot for the answer. You buy it towards the end of the year. You actively manage it for a very short period of time, and then you flip it back to Casey. You get that depreciation, and then you truly make it a passive investment and flip it over to Casey's team to manage. So that we're just trying to give you guys, the listeners, ideas, right? These are strategies to think about when you go into planning the best way to buy investment property.
And please coordinate with your CPA on this. Don't just go out and do it and then tell your CPA on April 1st that, hey, I did this. I'm looking forward to all the write-offs. And they go, well, where's your documentation that you were actively managing? Where's your logs? You know, show me that you spent 100 hours self-managing this in the last calendar year. And go, and you say, oops, I didn't do any of that. So work with your CPA on this, you know, if you're planning on implementing the strategy.
Totally. So Casey, what's next for Seabrook? I mean, I know you talked about the hospital, the school, the YMCA that you're developing, but my understanding, you've developed about 1,000 homes there. You know, what's kind of the look forward for 2025? Like, what kind of availability are you going to have? What houses are you building? What's kind of on top of mind for the next 6 to 12 months?
Well, so just to clarify, there's about 600 homes that are built.
Okay.
About half of those are in our rental program. So about 300 plus homes. The other half are just either people that live here full time, or they live here part time, or they're just a pure vacation home, you know, and they like the benefits of having the on-site management, because if they want us to, you know, stock their fridge or clean their house or, you know, maintain their hot tub, we can do all of that for them. And if they ever needed to put their house in the rental program, they love having that option to put their house in the rental program. You know, the number one focus is finishing this town center. You know, it's the main street and the town center that makes Bozeman and Carmel and Laguna Beach and all the great places out there. And that's the draw. That's the soul of those communities. And that's what creates tremendous real estate value. There's nothing more important than finishing our town center. And we are about to break ground on the final block. We expect to be done in the next 3 to 4 years. And the town will really sing when that town center is really complete. But yes, the new school, the community center, the first phase of the medical center. It's basically an urgent care clinic to start with. Those things are also going to make this just a more desirable place to vacation and also a more desirable place to live full time. And then we have two more villages that surround Seabrook that are approved, and we're breaking ground on the first one called Maker's Village, and that will actually have artisan merchants, leather makers, glass blowers, chocolate makers. I mean, all the kinds of experiential retail that really, you know, like what you see at Pike Street Market, creating, again, another memory when people come down here. And, you know, we're talking about, you know, San Diego, and you were talking about Hawaii earlier, Tate, but, you know, the happiest people in the world actually live in Finland and Sweden and Norway in climates that are actually more rugged than the Washington coast. And the reason is it's the placemaking. When you live in a walkable town or village and everything is, you know, accessible on foot, your quality of life goes way up, and you never want to go back to a suburban environment, which is why a lot of our people that bought as vacation homes, now they're retiring here. We hear from them, you know, their kids that go off to college, they'll come back and say, hey, mom, dad, whatever you do, don't sell the beach house. You can sell our old house that we grew up in, but don't sell the beach house. So I think it's the quality of life when you design the built environment in the right way. That really creates the value.
How big does it get? What's the critical mass?
So 700 acres, three villages. So Seabrook is like 1.0, and then 2.0 is Maker's Village, which is, by the way, like it'll probably take 2 minutes on a bicycle to get from one to the next.
Right.
I mean, it's super close. And then the third village will be Pacific Grove, which is kind of our crown jewel. It looks over the ocean, unobstructed views. We'll be doing a beach club, you know, right on the ocean, you know, a 4 or 5 star hotel, spa. So it's going to be pretty sweet.
Wow.
You know, one thing I wanted to bring up while we're on the topic of retirement homes, you know, buying a vacation rental and having it and then eventually retiring in it. I did want to bring up a strategy to think about as a pilot that has a self-directed IRA. I know there was one of our listeners was in the forum talking about, hey, has anybody ever bought rental property in their self-directed IRA? And I just wanted to kind of talk about a strategy in that real quick, where you could actually buy a vacation rental or any rental inside of your IRA. And there's actually companies out there that will lend to your home, non-recourse loan to your IRA, I should say. And you could actually go buy the vacation rental property, but just know that there's some restrictions to that. You can't actually personally benefit from the investment. So
yeah, you can't go stay in it.
Yeah, stay in it, things like that. So just, you know,
your kids can't stay in it. Your parents can't stay in it. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. There can't be, you know, this weird thing where you pay, you know, a bunch of money to the house, you know, an overcharge and, you know, stuff your retirement account with more money. But what's interesting about that is that when you actually go to retire, you can do a distribution to yourself, just like you would take mandatory distributions at 59 and a half or 64 or whatever, whenever it starts. You can actually distribute the house to yourself in retirement and then benefit from that house in retirement after you've made that distribution. So it's kind of a fun strategy where if you're like, hey, I'm betting big on Seabrook or any vacation rental place, I want to eventually live there. For now, my IRA is going to benefit from it. When I retire, then I can have the IRA make a distribution, literally distribute the house to you. Now, you pay taxes, but depending on how you do the distribution, whether it's Roth or traditional, whatever it might be, but then you can actually then benefit from the house physically after you retire. So just something to think about and talk to your tax strategist about when you're thinking about buying rental properties in your IRA.
Love it. Casey, how do people find out more about you? How do they find you? What roads do they take to wander down into Seabrook and knock on your door?
Seabrookwa.com is how you can learn more about it. It's hard to make a website really capture it. So the best thing is just to come out here and visit it and, you know, get your feet on the ground. Because I think the attention to detail really surprises people. You know, we're talking about all these investment opportunities and how to protect wealth, but we've really always been driven by the placemaking aspect and the community aspect. And that, by the way, is also what creates a great investment. But we usually shut down when someone's all about the investment side of it.
Right.
Because we're so passionate about the town design and the placemaking and again, building a strong community where people know their neighbors. And, you know, when you walk into the coffee shop, they know your name and they know what you want. I mean, it's something that people are really thirsty for. And that's why, again, people kind of have to see this place to believe it and experience it. You know, it's not a place you just drive through. You got to like spend the weekend and really, you know, kind of immerse yourself in it. And I mean, just on that note, 88% of our guests last year were repeat guests. So once we get people out here, they come back. And so it's now just, you know, again, getting the word out to more people.
That's cool.
Well, we've been back twice and you absolutely nailed it. We fell in love with the place. I mean, it really is amazing. I just wanted to think of an excuse to bring you on. So I didn't mean to go too heavy on the investing side, but
good. All good.
And if you do go to Seabrook, do yourself a favor. When you go to the candy shop that's downtown or the ice cream store, there's a refrigerator on the right-hand side of the cashiers and there's some homemade ice cream sandwiches, double cookie. They're wrapped in aluminum foil. And if they have any left, do yourself a favor and grab one of those. They are amazingly delicious. So
and the cookies are made across the street at our bakery. So yeah, that's the real deal.
Super cool.
Yeah. Well, thanks so much, Casey, for coming on. We really appreciate your knowledge and insights. Congrats on all your successes.
Thank you so much, guys. Really appreciate being on and I look forward to watching your show.
Thanks, Casey.
Thank you, sir.